Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Masha Raskolnikov. Raskolnikov received a PhD at the University of California at Berkeley. She is currently an associate professor in the Department of English at Cornell University, where she teaches medieval English literature, feminist studies, and critical theory. This spring, she will take the helm as interim director of feminist gender and sexuality studies at Cornell, and she is also author of Body Against Soul, Gender and Soul Heal in Middle English Allegory, published last year by Ohio State University Press. And this is the first book of a new series called Interventions, New Studies in Medieval Culture. Welcome to the show, Masha.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've said that one of the main reasons you became a medievalist was because you are interested in origins and where ourselves came from. Now, how does literature from the Middle Ages answer those questions for us now?
Literature from the Middle Ages is the first literature written in English. Before the English language as we know it is, of course, an ongoing invented and reinvented construct. But medieval English literature is where the crucible, where the literature we now know is formed. Of course, if I wanted to go all the way back, I guess I would be digging in caves and looking at cuneiform tablets. And perhaps a search for origins is always a contingent search. You always decide which origin you're going to pick. Some people want to look at the early 20th century as the invention of a lot of concepts that are important for the 21st. But I wanted to look specifically at the history of this literature, this English literature that we have, because this is the language that I was given to work with, and because of the disciplinary organization of universities, the department in which I would be sort of teaching that. And what I was really interested in studying English literature was where the words come from, where the concepts come from, the kind of embedded metaphors that become concepts, the way that we think about the divisions, we look at the world and divide it up into pieces, and those pieces we name, and so how we divided and redivided those. I was born with another language, and so for me, English is an achievement and a kind of gift, and so thinking about how English names and tell stories has always been really interesting to me.
Because it's different from what I grew up with. Your original language, obviously, is Russian. But you know, a lot of people would ask the question about origins and where our sense of self came from with psychology. And you chose literature. And you say that you think it might even just be a matter of the poets giving us the answers to these questions. Talk to us more about that.
I think the poets have always given us the answers. And, of course, if you look at psychology, something like Freud or Jung even, what you get is Freud and Jung making use of the poetic tradition to even name their more basic concepts. Psychology today has become a much more scientifically driven discipline, very experimental, and it's just not a kind of approach that to me personally captures the soul. And so for me, it's always been poetry, and it's always been the nature of the words used in poetry, something so small that becomes the building blocks of how we think about selves. So something even as simple in the book that I've written as this word soul heal, which is the strange medieval word, right in the middle of my title, everyone stumbles over it, soul heal with a W, which means something that's akin to a self-help psychology from the Middle Ages. It isn't what they practiced when people were sort of ill or when philosophers were theorizing things. It's what was for everyday people to think about how to get through the rest of their day. It was books that people carried in their pockets or books that people had in monasteries, so monks had in monasteries, for consultation about both how themselves to live their lives or if they were monks and preached, what kind of things to tell people who seek wisdom, who seek calm, who seek a way to love themselves, problems that we still face today.
Yeah, that's a very interesting word. And just for my listeners' information, it's spelled S-O-W-L-E-H-E-L-E. And, you know, I was thinking it was some kind of a Swahili or Dutch word or something at first.
But it's actually Middle English. It's actually an early form of those words. I wanted to preserve the strange alienness of the way that that was spelled. There are multiple spellings. Standardized spelling doesn't actually exist in English for centuries after this. But I found this word. I went to the British Library and I started looking at manuscripts where some of the poetry I wanted to write about had come from. And I kept coming across this word maybe in the title page of a manuscript explaining what the manuscript was for. And that really captured my imagination. And like medieval literature itself, it captured my imagination because it's both very much like what we think about today and, you know, with that W right in the middle of the soul, very different.
Mm-hmm.
And that similarity and difference is what I really study.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book, Body Against Soul. Let's talk about that whole concept of body against soul. That was the huge debate in much of this literature.
Yes.
So tell us.
Well, really the way that I come to this is I think about when we talk about the Middle Ages, the kinds of stereotypes we hold about that time, that it was dark and dirty and people were terribly unhappy. That would be one kind of stereotype. That it was fun and festive and people wore peaked hats and damsels got rescued by knights in shining armor. That would be another stereotype.
Uh-huh.
Philosophically, the stereotype would be that it was a time governed by superstition and religious fear, where religion really functioned as a kind of boogeyman. And when the idea, the dualism between the soul and the body, the division, seemed very tragic and inevitable, and the soul was going to heaven and the body was going to rot, and these were terrible, dramatic realities that people worried about. And so philosophically, we say that dualism, this notion that the body and the self are separable, comes from the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating concept. It's something we're still debating.
I think it is something we're still debating. Now, in the 20th and 21st century, what really happened is that we started questioning that division. We started saying, well, how can we actually separate this? And science questions it by talking about how hormones and the endocrine system, probably mispronounced endocrine system.
I'm not sure.
Shows you how much I know about science, how much these things influence our actual thought, our moods, of course, and antidepressants able to make people happy and all this kind of stuff. So we actually violate the division of body and soul when we think like that. Feminists in the 20th century also really wanted to question the primacy of the soul over the body.
Mm.
The body is traditionally associated with femininity and women with sin. And so to take back the body, to take back its functions, its needs, and its appetites was a really major feminist project. It was part of that whole the personal is the political mm-hmm. move that feminism made from the early 70s onward. And I think of my project as really participating in that, but also trying to heal the divide. Because when you start actively taking back the body, then everyone starts writing books about the body, wonderful books, books that were really important to me, like The Body in Pain or Bodies That Matter. But in some ways, I started asking the question, well, where does that come from? And where's the soul in all this?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the theological soul that goes to heaven, but just, is the body that we're going to theorize and love, what part of it is language? What part of it is poetry? Is that the soul? Would we say that?
Mm-hmm.
And so asking those questions led me deeper and deeper into these medieval debates between the body and the soul.
Which are fascinating.
They're really beautiful poems.
And you know what? I just want to bring this up because medieval authors imagine the soul and the body possessing the capacity to even have a dialogue after death.
Yeah, this was a philosophical kind of dialogue that is often, it's not pretty poetry in the way that Keats would be pretty poetry,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but it is fascinating poetry, and it goes all the way back. When I was researching this book, I found work about Egyptian body-soul debates. So this actually, when I talk about origins and how contingent they are, the origins of body-soul debate are shrouded in history. And yet, if I look at medieval English body-soul debates, they are a particularly vibrant and interesting tradition, one that as a scholar I was fortunate not that many people were studying. And so I could go in there and I could ask those feminist questions about these debates and say, wow, in these poems, the body somehow has the capacity to think because it's talking and making arguments, and the soul has the capacity to speak even though the vocal cords
are in the
pertain
body.
To the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so how are they imagining this? How are they, and they actually worried about this, you know, what are the genders of body and soul? How, you know, is one male, is one female? Are they both male if they belong to a male person? Those kinds of very literal-minded questions become really interesting.
Yeah, and often it seems in your book it sounded like the body was often having to defend itself against the soul's accusations.
Because traditionally the body is the seat of appetites and dirt and decay and sex and laziness and the desire for things you can't have. And the soul is supposedly above all that. So for me, that is a profoundly interesting thing. To divide the lower and the higher in that way seems self-explanatory how problematic that is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet, it's also an important way of talking about how we don't understand ourselves, how we can be a mystery to ourselves, how sometimes the things we want and the things we think we want are at odds with one another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's part of what body-soul debates kind of did for medieval people, is that they explained how their selves could be at odds, how they could want multiple things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. To tell us about this, I want to know, did they differentiate between the soul and the mind in these writings?
No, the soul, the category soul encompassed lots of different things, but it tended to be body, soul, and maybe there'd be a separate or different category for will, which of course could be a bodily thing when the will is bad or a soul thing when the will is good.
Mm-hmm.
But the mind is something that we think of as in a more interesting way. Medieval psychologists thought about the mind and subdivided it into imagination and rationality and knowledge. But the soul heal literature didn't get that far. It was just like, here are your impulses, here are your passions. How do we think about that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you do combine medieval English literature with feminist studies. So tell us more about how those two, that they intersect, if you will. I mean, you talked about taking back the body, and that was a feminist study and notion, especially during the early 70s, to our bodies, ourselves, and so on.
Absolutely.
But tell us more about how those two might intersect.
Well, thank you for saying our bodies, ourselves. I hadn't thought of that, but that is the most fundamental sort of move, and that's a book that we're all very familiar with.
Yeah.
I have a vintage copy.
Many generations, yes.
Yes. Well, how interesting. The feminist... Okay, look. The thing that's interesting about the body and the soul is also that they are always being analogized to the man and his wife.
Mm.
And I say man and his wife with irony on purpose, but it's always, the mind or soul should rule the body the way the husband should rule the wife. Mm. And that analogy is biblical, and it persists, St. Paul, and it persists after that. And so it's always a question of feminist interventions being necessary when these kinds of analogies are being made. But really, back to the thing about origins. When we look at something that's historically distant, the way the Middle Ages are distant, one of the things that we get is some sense, and I think a sense we can question, of what is normal and what is not normal.
Mm.
In other words, if we say that the oppression of women has persisted throughout history, one way to say that is, well, it's inevitable. Women are just less than. That's why they're always oppressed. And so to find more complicated ways of looking at the history of how women are sort of down and men are up, which is a terribly simple way of putting it, but you know what I mean.
Well, we're striving for equality.
Equality, but we want to question why things have been so unequal for a long time. And I am kind of an old-fashioned feminist, and I see this, the disparity in wages, all this kind of very simple stuff is still ongoing. Well, I want to know where that concept comes from. I want to go to that origin. I want to see if that origin was right. I want to see if that origin might be questioned and unmade. And if you can go back to that origin, and this is sort of my dream when I teach this stuff and when I write about it, when you go back to the origin, what if you could start again?
Mm.
What if you could say things could be otherwise? Because if you unmake some misstep early on or question that misstep, what new things can you imagine?
Mm.
So it's not that we could relive history, but it's that we could reimagine history in a new way.
And so that's where feminist studies intersects with the Middle Ages.
Yeah, plus
trying to figure out
what I'm interested in.
Where some of these concepts came from that we still use today.
Yeah.
And then we haven't gotten rid of some of the prejudices. Now people often ask you how medieval literature is relevant today, and your answer, at least in one interview, was, the experience of reading literature because it's beautiful is critical to the education of any human being. Talk to us more about that. That seems to be a dying notion these days.
Actually, I wouldn't say that it's a dying notion. Mm. In my classes at Cornell and in my life in the world, people are always approaching me. They find out I'm an English professor, or they come to my class, and they can be engineering students. They can be people who got degrees in veterinary degrees. My doctor interrogates me. People are actually deeply in need of, I'm going to say it, beauty. And they are deeply in need of the kind of questions and answers and concepts that are not so concrete and not so oriented towards the basic stuff of making money and getting food on the table.
We actually need
a different life, a life of the mind. I'm going to say a life of the soul, and I don't mean that religiously, but a life of the soul that responds to poetry and art and music and things like that. I believe this really deeply. I don't think it's going anywhere. We are in a moment when young people are being urged to study practical things because we are in a crisis and we don't quite know when that financial crisis is going to end. And I'm sad that this moment has come and that so many young people are afraid of studying something just for their soul and feel that they need to push everything towards getting a job when they graduate. But the question I always want to ask is, well, what do you do after you've gotten that job? What do you come home to? What do you think about in the idle hours? What do you think about at night? I once had a student from a very disadvantaged background come into my office for office hours for the first time, and I keep some percentage of my collective library in my office, so it kind of goes to the ceiling. And he looked around and said, "Wow, you must have so much to think about when you're alone." And I said to him, "Yes, this is exactly why you're in my class, because I want you to have more stuff to think about that isn't just the basic stuff of survival." This is a story about a student with a disadvantaged background, but it could just as easily be a story about an MBA.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Masha Raskolnikov. She is Associate Professor of English at Cornell University, and we are talking about her book, Body Against Soul, Gender and Soul Heal in Middle English Allegory. Now, in your classes, you make references to contemporary culture and contemporary politics by invoking medieval literature. Tell us how some of those things cross paths. And how does contemporary politics meet medieval literature? Examples?
Well, I'm thinking. It's not as simple as, you know, this electoral strategy parallels a medieval parliament. It's not ever like that. I guess this past week I've been doing introductory lectures for a Chaucer class. I have to lecture in the beginning because they need basic information. And from there they can start doing their own thing. And I've been talking about the Black Death and how the plague that got carried largely by rats, you know, and a little bit people, actually managed to kill in Chaucer's lifetime about a third of the population of medieval Europe, which is a crazy number. And it's not like every third person dropped dead. It would be entire villages or parts of villages that where it would, you know, sort of go off like a flame. And I was talking about this to Cornell undergraduates who, of course, just went through and are still going through a panic about the swine flu. And who are talking to me about the panic about contagion that they experienced and the kind of Purell everywhere situation that they've been in. And we were talking just about the fact that we know where swine flu comes from, and we know, I'm sorry, H1N1 flu, because we don't want to stigmatize the pigs, and we know.
That's right.
And we know about germs, or we feel that we now know scientifically what's going on.
And how infection is carried.
Yes, and in the Middle Ages they didn't, and they had their own theories that were different and less effective, let's say, for guarding against these things, and just what it would have meant to not know where it's coming from and try to guard against it. That's very immediate, because this is something that Ithaca and Cornell have been living through very recently. And I just, it's an interesting way to think about plague, because it is very much about stigma and fear and the fear of gathering together.
Yeah, and things go in circles, right? I mean, the huge plague in the Middle Ages, and now we are afraid that one is coming upon us now. So nothing has changed, even though we have progressed medically, perhaps.
Hopefully a third of the population isn't going
no,
to
No, I mean, in regard to the fear and, yes, and the same kind of reactions as we saw.
Fear and stigma are very important categories to think with about plague, and certainly the medieval people knew all about that.
And we learned more about that, too, when AIDS started surfacing in our country.
And there are some really interesting work, actually, by medieval scholars about intersections, comparisons, and also differences between plague and plague stories and AIDS. So that work is actually a work that medievalists have undertaken. Although plague is really something that has swept the world and different parts of the world, I'm going to say throughout history, although as a scholar you're not supposed to say throughout history. So, you know, there's always been plague, and the Middle Ages are not unique in that, but it was a particularly devastating plague. And it's interesting to think about how it's different from the kinds of plagues we get now.
Now, how has studying these body and soul debates affected your idea of yourself? Has this changed you in any way, as just personally?
What a wonderful question. I'll say two things. One is, I wrote this book, I began it in graduate school, and then I worked on it for the first many years of being a professor at Cornell. It's taken 10 years, and it was very hard for me to finish this book. It was hard work, and while I wrote it, I didn't take terribly good physical care of myself. Mm. I didn't exercise very much. I didn't actually even know how to cook. Being a very, very good student was kind of a way of putting all of my eggs into that soul basket and not taking care of the body.
Mm.
And writing this book did not actually cure me of that. As I wrote it, I took terrible care of myself. And that was, and I knew that this was an irony, and I thought, God, I wish I could resolve this irony, but I couldn't. So that's one way to answer the question. I'll also say, just because for me it's an important story and I'm okay sharing this on radio, while I was finishing the book, my father had a massive stroke, and for about 12 hours while me and my brothers tried to get to Michigan, where he was in the hospital, they kept him alive for us on machines. And so I came into the hospital room and saw my father's body, and I knew that the brain, had suffered a terrible hemorrhage and that he would never recover, that there would be no more my father again.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, I kind of saw the body without its soul. I don't really believe that he was hovering over this. I really believe that he was gone. And I experienced that disjunct, that terrible breakage where the body can be there, but the thing that inhabited the body, the person you love, is gone. And that was because I had been working on this for so long, I of course thought about my own work in that terrible moment in a way that was actually kind of healing and important.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also realized something that is also part of what I write about in the book, which is that the body matters just by itself, that we should and could love the body, even though I have done that imperfectly myself. And that to love the body of my father meant I wanted to smell him again.
Mm.
I wanted to hold his hand again while it was still warm, because just the body, even without the soul, is still someone that you love.
But you saw the stark separation of the body and the
soul
at that
moment. Both the separation and, in some ways, the importance of both were present at that moment. And I realized that I'd been writing this book in a way in order to prepare for that loss.
Mm.
And that was in some ways the most important thing about this book for me, was that I got a moment of understanding what was happening at the time that it was happening to me, and had an intellectual thing that I could work with, which of course cheers up an academic to be able to go to an intellectual place.
And run to one, perhaps.
Oh, yes. People would testify, we run to the intellectual. But also, it enriched this experience for me. It made it livable.
I can imagine.
And that was very important. I kind of can't believe I just told you that story.
Well, I was going to ask you about that anyway, because you said you chose academia because of the influence of your father, who was a literature teacher in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he said, that he believed that teaching critical thinking skills helped people to be free, even in a totalitarian state. To tell us more about how that influence of your father got you into academia.
When I was a little girl, my father was a high school teacher in Russia. Because he was Jewish, he hadn't been allowed to study as he had wanted to become a professor. In the Soviet Union, Jews were not supposed to sort of possess or operate higher culture. That was supposed to be reserved for people of Russian descent, whatever that meant. And so my father had gone to teacher's college and had a degree equivalent to a BA, and was a brilliant, self-educated literary scholar. In the States, he actually became a professor of Russian literature. But that was later. And so he taught in a high school, and because he was a really great teacher, I aspire to emulate how good a teacher he was. He taught at a very good high school, and in fact was a kind of, and this is hard to imagine, a kind of minor celebrity. I think that Ithaca High School English teachers or other teachers sometimes have that minor celebrity status in Ithaca as well. I would walk down the streets of Moscow, and I have vivid memories of running into my father's former students and having them incredibly impressed by him and sort of slightly worshipful. He was that good, I say with annoying daughterly pride. And that was an introduction to me to the fact that teachers were important, that was a noble profession, something I very deeply believe. But also, he was teaching in a totalitarian state where freedom of speech was just an idea, and where a lot of important literature of that very country was banned.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't teaching that banned literature in his classes. That would have gotten him sent to a Siberian detention camp, which would not have been nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what he did is he taught the stuff he was given, which was sometimes just junk, in a way, and this is hard to describe, but in a way that inherently, implicitly taught his students to think for themselves.
Mm.
And that's what I think the humanities in general can do. And I always talk about what it means to think critically in a totalitarian state, to imagine that life can be otherwise because you're reading literature in a totalitarian state.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't teach in a totalitarian state. I can teach whatever I want. Now I have tenure. I could go to the moon. But that's still the impulse that drives me, because actually when the Soviet Union fell, a lot of my father's former students were able to step up and become some of the intellectual leaders, and in some cases some of the political leaders that could imagine a free Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they've done that not so very well in the past decade, but I'm not blaming my father. But they were there. They had that kind of training, and there were precious few people with the courage to teach that you could be critical in the way that my father taught.
Well, I think that's a lesson that still needs to be passed on in this democracy of ours, teaching critical thinking so that people will stay free.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
I believe that very
kind of thing can be taken away from one very easily in little increments where we don't even notice.
Yes, I really believe that as well.
Yeah.
And yet I would distinguish between the great freedoms we enjoy in the United States and the ridiculous small space of freedom that I remember from childhood.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
I didn't want that to be forgotten too quickly.
That's right. No, I absolutely agree with you on that one. Now, we only have a couple minutes left. You're going to be the interim director of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies Program. Tell us if you have any new ideas. Are you going to make some changes? How are you going to deal with them?
Oh, gosh, this is not going to be an interesting part of the show. I am just the interim director. I get the gig for something like 3 months.
Uh-huh.
My plan is just to keep the program afloat, plan some exciting speakers for the fall. I can't really organize anything for the spring because it's already spring. At some future date, I may become director in a real way of FGSS. I usually take projects on because I have some kind of secret pet project going on. I was the director of the Lesbian and Gay Studies Program and got it renamed the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Studies Program. Mm-hmm. It was LGB before, and organized a big conference about transgender studies, not a field I really work in, but a field I really read in and really admire,
mm-hmm.
taught a class, organized a conference, and got the name changed all in 1 2-year term that was crazy. And so I know that there'll be a pet project, but I don't really truly have a plan for one yet.
Okay, well, we'll listen up and see if we can find something happening up there with you at the reins. Are you working on anything really quickly? Any more books? Any more?
I've actually just come off of a sabbatical where I had a lot of time and leisure to think up a new book project and start research for one. I am going to try to write a book. I haven't really started writing it, so we don't know if it's going to gel, about over-apologizing, about how the apology, but really the over-apology, is both a kind of self-abjection and also a kind of demand from the other person. So when you go at them and you apologize and then you apologize again and you can't stop apologizing, what kinds of effects that has? What kinds of things are you asking when you do that? Now, I'm writing about this in the Middle Ages, but I have to be honest, I'm a little tempted to also do a little spin-off project, just a little thin book, because I think that just theorizing and thinking about what it means to apologize would be really interesting, especially in our current both political and sort of paparazzi news climate.
Mm,
and I'm sort of working towards that.
Oh, well, we will eagerly await that. Well, Masha Raskolnikov, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.